in a low trust environment, you are 10 times more likely to look at disagreement at something that's unproductive. You're trying to avoid it. You don't think that it's going to help, than in a high trust environment.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok. My guest today is Yoram Solomon. Here's three facts I believe you should know about Yoram. One, so far he's published 14 books, including The Book of Trust. Two, he served at the Israeli Defense Forces 35th Airborne Brigade. Better not mess with him. And three, he shared his birthday with a few people I think you've heard of, Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Stephen Hawking, and Kim Jong-un. I can imagine the parties the group of you would have together and the stories you could tell if you could all get together on the same day. And if you're wondering, folks, what date is Elvis's birthday, it's January the 8th. Yoram, welcome to Your Intended Message.
George, thank you for having me.
Yoram, delighted to be talking with you today on the topic of trust. And it's curious that on my wall here, among other reminders I have for me, and on the whiteboard off to my side here, I have a checklist, process to create an agreement, a service and agreement. And I've got five steps. And the first step is to establish trust. Before we talk about service, before we talk about price, before we talk about delivery, I think it's got to start with trust. And even though we probably know that, why do you think so many people mess up the trust equation? What do they get wrong?
I think that today we are very focused on the tactics. We're very focused on doing something very, very specific. And for me, in my personal journey that led me to where I am today, I started with innovation. You started with messaging and communication. So I started with innovation. And what I realized after a while is that companies cannot innovate if they don't have a culture of innovation. And that was actually the topic of my doctoral research for 2 years. But one day I realized that even innovation culture, if you start breaking it down into the components of it, there is not a single component that will exist in a positive way if you didn't have trust as the foundation. And so the analogy to me was that you don't start with innovation, because this would be just like starting to build a building from the second floor. You don't start with innovation culture, because that would be like starting to build from the first floor. You have to start with the foundation. And we typically focus on those things that we need to accomplish, we need to achieve, we need to communicate today, rather than what is the foundation for that message to be delivered in an effective way, in a creative way.
Now that's interesting. I was talking with a colleague who was telling me that they were trying to create more, they wanted to inspire more creative thinking and ideas in their meetings. And they were frustrated that people weren't engaging in creative thinking or even speaking creatively. Do you think maybe there wasn't enough trust there?
Exactly. I mean, this was exactly the path that I took, because I, in my research, what I found was that one of the most important parts of to be creative, for a team to be creative, is the ability to hold something that I call constructive disagreement. It's, George, when you and I can argue passionately over something on the two opposite sides of this, and yet stay friends and even become more of friends than we were before. And we're never taking it personally. We never become emotional. We are passionate, but not emotional. We're not irrational. We stay rational. We stay pragmatic. And in one of my studies, I found that I asked people, what do you feel about disagreement in the workplace? And some people said, I would rather not disagree. I try to avoid it. Some people think that it's just unproductive. Some people think that it can lead to confrontations and conflict, and they try to avoid it altogether. And then there are a few people who said that I feel that I can argue with someone and stay friends. Some say I feel that I can passionately argue and stay friends. And when I broke it down, I asked additional questions about trust, the level of trust. And when I correlated, here's what I found. In a low trust environment, you are 10 times more likely to look at disagreement as something that's unproductive, you're trying to avoid it, you don't think that it's going to help, than in a high trust environment.
And I can certainly account for working in a low trust environment at one time. And it was, don't tell anyone what you're thinking. Yeah, don't want them to know. And fortunately, I didn't stay there very long. And I suppose in any team, if you want to build a team, the leader's gotta go first. So how does the leader go first to build trust?
I think it's a question not only of the leader, but in any relationship. Because you see, the level of trust that you have in me is the product of your trustability, your willingness to trust other people, and my trustworthiness. There's almost nothing that I can do about the former, your willingness to trust people, because you know we're the sum of our experiences. You're the sum of your experiences, George. But I can do everything I can, anything, about my own trustworthiness. And so I have a certain level of trustworthiness. Now the question is, how do you start? Where do you start your level of trust in me? You can start at exactly my level of trustworthiness, and that's where it's going to stay. You can start at zero. And when you start at zero, there's something I should add. By the way, I wrote the 8 laws of trust in the book of trust. And one of those laws is that trust is reciprocal. And so I want to explain this to explain how does a leader start. So trust is reciprocal. We like to think of trust being reciprocal in that if I'm trustworthy, then you are going to trust me. Trust is reciprocal, but it actually works the other way around as well. If you start by trusting me, if you show me that you trust me, I will behave in a more trustworthy way because I would feel that I need to justify the trust that you have in me. So as a leader, or even as a team member, you can start at a low level of trust, at a level of trust that's lower than my trustworthiness. Here is what's going to happen. I'm going to feel that you don't trust me because really that's the message you communicate to me. That's your intended message, whether you like it or not. So you communicate to me that you don't trust me that much. And therefore, my level of trustworthiness, at least in our relationship, because trust is also relative, it's unique to every relationship, my level of trustworthiness will start declining. However, if you start at a higher level of trust, at a level of trust that is higher than my real objective trustworthiness, I will start behaving in a more and more trustworthy way to justify the trust that you showed me that you have in me. So my answer to that, and Ernest Hemingway said it the best way to know if you can trust someone is to trust them.
Best way to know if you can trust someone is to trust them. Now
that's Ernest Hemingway, not me.
That is something to think about. Now, here's an incident that happened recently with my dad. He took his truck in to have the brakes done, and later he discovered that they weren't done properly, and he went back, and the shop foreman didn't seem to take him seriously. And my dad related this to me, and his comment, which I thought was curious, was, well, you can't trust anybody these days. Is that a typical reaction when one feels that their trust has been misplaced?
You know, I'm so happy that you asked that question, because in another survey that I did, I actually wanted to see, you know, I did in one of my surveys, one of my first surveys, when I started researching the topic of trust, what I found was that when I asked people, what is the most important quality for you in other people? And I gave them six types of people: your boss, your employee, your peer, a salesperson trying to sell you something, your government representative, or your spouse. And I asked, what is the most important quality? Number one, with 61.2%, was trustworthiness. It was more than the next four combined. But, you know, on salespeople or service people where you have a financial interaction with, that was the highest number. It was 77.6%, if I remember correctly. And I wanted to know, you know what? Are you willing to put your money where your mouth is? You're telling me that the most important quality for you in salespeople is their trustworthiness, 77.6% of the time. Three out of four people, when they were asked about the salesperson, trustworthiness was number one. So are you willing to put your money where your mouth is? And so I did another scenario and I asked people, and we took something that would probably be just about the ballpark or order of magnitude of what your father's experience was, about a $10,000 home renovation project. That was really my survey. It was a home renovation project. And I gave them the scenario. I described two salespeople trying to close a deal with you. And one of them came in, he's the owner of his business, he's been in business for 20 years, good reviews. I kind of built in all of the components of trustworthiness. Then I talked about the interaction where he was really listening, was really giving advice that was clearly given to give you what you need rather than me, what I want to get out of you. And that was one. And the other one I described as, you know, unfortunately, a little more typical, which is, you know, I'm in it for the money, I'm in it for the commission, and I want to go in and out, and I'm going to maximize what I make out of it rather than what you get out of it. So I described these two, and one of them, obviously, without really saying it, one of them was trustworthy, the other one was not. And then I asked, at the end of the day, both of them gave you quotes. The quotes were identical. Which one would you choose? Well, people thought when I asked this question, people think it's a trick question. It's not a trick question. I mean, obviously, you're going to go with the trustworthy one. But then when I asked, what if the trustworthy one would have asked for 10% higher price? George, 100% still went with the trustworthy one. 10% higher price, $11,000, $1,000 more, 100%. Then I asked, how about 20%? Well, at 20%, now we were down to 54% would still choose the trustworthy one. 44% would say it's still going to be one of them. I need to ask more questions and understand more. Not a single one said, I'm going to go with the untrustworthy one, even at 20%. So I continued to do that and built on it. And I reached an interesting number. And I'll put that in a statement. A trustworthy salesperson would be able to sell the same product or service for 29.6% higher price and still get the deal. This is how important trustworthiness is.
I better raise my prices.
First, make sure that people see you as trustworthy. Make sure that you work on all the six components of trustworthiness.
Joram, please tell us what those six components are, because I'm sure there's people out there who want that 29.6%, if only they could appear and be, both be and appear to be more trustworthy. What are those six components?
I'm so glad you asked. Actually, I didn't even know that you knew about the six components. Of course. So I look at them as, think of three of them as your brand, and three of them is what happens in an interaction, because there's part of it that's your brand. And your brand has three parts: your competence, the level of shared values that we have, you and I, and this is why it's trust is relative, because you and I may have shared values, certain shared values that you may not have with somebody else, or I may not have with somebody else. So competence, shared values, and fairness or symmetry of the relationship. Those are, I would call them the brand components. But then there are the transaction or interaction components. And the first one is the positivity of the interaction. I mean, think about your father going to that store, and what did he get, or what did he hear, or how did the person at the store treat him? That ranked pretty low on positivity. By the way, positivity is made of two subcomponents: the level of BS that you bring into that interaction, and the level of empathy or self-centrism, which unfortunately a study showed that in the last 51 years, the level of self-centrism in 78 countries increased by 12%. Now, you may say that 12% is not a lot, but in English-speaking countries, that level increased by 69%. 69%. We are 69% more self-centered today. So the positivity of that interaction depends on how much BS do you get from the other side, or do you give the other side, and how self-centered versus empathetic they are towards you or you towards them. The second component is the amount of time. You know, we rely on very short interactions. Well, in short interactions and very infrequent interactions, we don't build a lot of trust. Longer interactions, more frequent interactions, we build more trust. And it's amazing to see how as time goes by, you start building that level of trust, even with people you don't agree with ideologically. Or the third component is intimacy. And by intimacy, what I mean is, you know, get away from sending text messages, get away from sending emails, talk to a person, let them hear your tone of voice. Even better than that, let them see your body language. So to me, a first meeting, I always prefer a first meeting, whether it's me selling something or me buying something or any other interaction, me supporting a candidate who's running for city council or school board or anything else. The first meeting, I try to make sure that it's in person so that they can see my body language and I can see theirs. Those are the six components. So the three brand ones: competence, shared values, and fairness or symmetry of the relationship. The three interactional or transactional ones are the positivity, time, and intimacy.
Yoram, in order to have a trusting relationship, do all six of those need to be there at some level?
So first of all six of them are there, and we are judging whether we do it consciously or subconsciously. We're judging all six of them. You know, I'm glad that you asked this. I'm going to show you something in the background. I wasn't planning on showing in the background, but these are my, this is my mathematical model for those six components. So I'm going to take it off. It's all in, obviously, the Book of Trust or the Book of Trust. But there is an interaction between them. And I even explain in the book, what is the interaction? If one of them is on zero, it doesn't mean that I'm going to have zero trust in you. I'm not going to have a lot, but it's not going to be zero. And so there is a combination of them that we're shooting to optimize or to maximize to increase the level of trust.
In the workplace, during a time of crisis and or change, trust, I imagine, has got to be more important, but yet that's probably the most difficult time to establish trust. Is that fair?
It's fair, but how about if I give you a trick on how to, especially at times of change, especially in times of a transformation in the organization, how you build trust? You know, I told you about shared values, and there are actually three types. We're digging a level down now. There are three types of shared values. There are universal shared values. Universal shared values are universal. I mean, nobody's going to trust somebody who lies to you intentionally and knowingly, right? You're not going to trust that person because that person is a liar. That's universal. There are personal shared values. So, you know, unfortunately, a lot of politics gets into the workplace. And if one person is a Republican, the other is a Democrat, there's not a lot of trust or love between them. And that's a personal value. But then there's also a, I call it situational shared values. And situational shared values is, to, in lack of a better term, a common enemy. Okay, there is a common enemy. And, you know, having served in the military, the definition of enemy is very, very clear. It's the people who shoot at you. They're your enemy. The people who shoot in the same direction as you, they're not the enemy. It's very simple. It's black and white there. But when it gets to the workplace or anything other than the military standard definition of the word enemy, if you can identify a shared enemy, that helps build trust in the form of shared values. The shared enemy can be a person, you know, our boss, you know, what he did and how he did this and so on. And the fact that you and I feel the same actually builds a bond of trust between you and me. But a shared enemy can be a budget, a schedule, a competitor, or anything else. So the sooner you can identify shared enemy, and unfortunately, they're so much easier to spot, unfortunately or fortunately, they're so much easier to spot when the organization is undergoing a transformation or a change, a significant change. They're easy to spot. And as long as you and I realize that we have the same perspective on them, we have a shared value. It's a circumstantial, a situational shared value, and we build trust faster.
Now, I'm curious, does that mean that a quick way for a boss to get the team to connect with each other is to treat them all like crap and the boss becomes the shared enemy?
I'm so glad you took this out of what I said. You have to be to keep in mind that, you know, if you look at the boss as someone who's outside of the team, then yes, you're right. I mean, a mean boss is going to bond the team, but the team is not going to be a significant part of the company and its vision and its objectives because the boss is all of a sudden not part of it.
What, Yoram, has there been a time in your life when there was someone or something that you trusted and they did something, something changed, and you have never trusted them again? Has that ever happened to you?
You know, it has. It obviously has several times in my life. I don't want to go into very specific descriptions or name names. I will name the names downstairs in the comp. No, I'm not. I'm not going to name the names. You know, I'll...
What did they do? What did they do that destroyed your trust?
The biggest thing for me is, you know, and I'll kind of tell you part of the story, but I am different people react differently to if there's something that let's imagine that you're traveling, okay? You're traveling somewhere and something happens to a family member. Now, you're in travel. There's nothing that you can do about it. Would you want to know about it? Now, from my perspective, I look at you and I go, well, there's nothing you can do about it, George. So, you know, why should I tell you? Why should I, you know, affect your trip and so on? Well, different people would prefer different things. So for me, for example, I would want to know, even if I can't do anything, I would want to know. And it was one time that I came from a trip to find out that somebody was not telling me something because it might, you know, affect me and there's nothing I can do about it. And that lack of transparency really hurt me. You know, when I talked about the truth, there's the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And so I want to know the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. If there's something that you can't tell me because it's confidential, you know, some leaders would say, I don't know anything about that. And you know that they're lying to you. That loses trust. That loses your trust. That happened to me too. When someone, you know, someone who was in a position of power knew something about a reorganization in our group. And, you know, I went to her and I said, look, I know what's happening. And can you give me more detail? And she said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, look, you know, not only that you know what I'm talking about, you know that I know. And so there are people who would say, I don't know, play dumb. You lose trust that way, especially if I know. The second is when people say, I'll tell you, but don't tell anybody that I told you. I know that initially you would think, oh, this is great. So they are telling me. But from that moment on, you would know that this is a person who's going to disclose confidential information, including yours. My preference would always be when somebody says, look, I cannot discuss these things with you. Something is going on. All I need you to know is one thing, George. I've got your back. We're going through a change. I can't tell you the details, but I've got your back. Well, it takes a long time of building that level of trust where you, George, would say, you know what? Yoram has my back. I don't need to worry about that. I don't need more details.
When you first meet someone, perhaps you're hiring new people to join your team, and you sit down and you want to make the right decision, and we've got all these questions we go through, but what characteristics or habits could you look for that suggests that this person could be trusted, or, you know, it's worth checking out more? And at the same time, what red flags would tell you, nope, push him out the door?
Well, there are the obvious things, right? I mean, you want to know that that they're competent in what they do. And those are the type of things that can be objectively measured and simply by checking references and, you know, what other people said and so on, people that you believe will tell you the truth. Shared values are things that you can start asking about. You got to be careful, obviously, with what you ask and what's not appropriate to ask. But the longer you have the conversation, the more you feel that you have asked questions that make you feel that we have some shared values. Here's a biggie, okay? And that is Albert Mehrabian published a book in 1971 called Silent Messages. And this is, everybody quotes this. And since you're in the area of communications and your podcast, your intended message is in the area of communications, you know that a lot of people misquoted him to say that, you know, communication is conveyed 7% through your words, 38% through your tone of voice, and 55% through your body language. That's a misquote of him. He really talked about liking, and he talked about feelings that you have towards another person. And I even went deeper than that. But he wrote something that was brilliant in the foreword to that 1971 book. He wrote, when your message, when your nonverbal communications disagree or are in conflict with the words that you use, with your verbal communications, people mistrust you. That's, I butchered it a little, but in essence, this is something, and this is, by the way, why it is so important for me to see you and hear you, especially in the first meeting, because what I'm doing, and in my case, having been a researcher of trust for the last 13 years, I'm doing it a lot more consciously than other people, but for other people, this might happen subconsciously. I see it's not whether what you say is what I want you to say, as it is what you're saying and what your body language and tone of voice are saying, are they consistent? I would rather you be consistent with your body language and what you say, body language, tone of voice, everything nonverbal. I would rather you be consistent and say something I'm not crazy about than if you say exactly what I want to hear, but your body language, your nonverbal communication, your verbal communication are consistent. That to me, when it's inconsistent, that's a major red flag. And I got to a point where I would never hire somebody like that.
And I'm glad you point out that misrepresentation of Albert Mehrabian's numbers. It wasn't about communication. It was about likability. And that interesting that you point out that when the visual, the body language is, it contrasts with the words, that's when we have a disruption. That's when we're thinking there's something wrong here. It's not making sense.
And that goes back into that one component, one of the three components of the interaction or transaction between us, intimacy. You're not going to know that. And, you know, unfortunately, you know what we do when we don't see the person or we don't hear the person, we read? we make assumptions. And when we make assumptions, we could be wrong. You know, I have to tell you, especially because your podcast, Your Intended Message, deals with communications, I have to tell you a story that just happened to me this week on Tuesday. So I'm very involved with our local politics. I served on the Plano Independent School District Board of Trustees, and I helped other candidates get elected. Well, I helped a candidate get elected 2 years ago, and about a year ago, she stopped communicating with me. And I thought, you know, she was pretty, I don't know. I mean, I really didn't know why she stopped communicating with me. Well, I helped a few other candidates get elected. And this week, last Tuesday, was their, they took the oath of office. And so I saw that trustee who has not communicated with me for a year. And I went to her and I asked her, hey, what happened? Why did you stop communicating with me? And she said, I could ask you the same question. I thought, wait, I stopped communicating with you? And she showed me a text that she had sent me. And as it turns out, when that text showed up in my phone, because we found it on my phone, it had no caller ID associated. And I looked at my answer and I could feel what I felt at that moment. Somebody was asking. I didn't know who that person was. Unfortunately, I didn't do what I would recommend anybody does. And that is, before you answer, just say, can't recognize the number. Who is this, please? And I didn't do that. I made an assumption of who this person was. I was wrong in that assumption. So the way I answered, she looked at the answer and she said, whoa, this is how he's answering me. I don't know why he doesn't want to stay in touch with me. A year went by. We made assumptions about the other person, assumptions that would not have happened if that was a face-to-face interaction.
Powerful lesson. Great reminder. Yoram, I know you have some helpful resources on your website for people who are interested in learning more about how to build and maintain trust. Your website, tell us where it is, please.
Yes, it's not just my website. My website is YoramSolomon.com. But even more than that, George, I made something specifically for your listeners and your viewers. So if they go to YoramSolomon.com/yourintendedmessage, it is going to look just like this. This is a page that's especially made for your listeners. And it has some resources. It has videos. It has links to videos. It has links to the books, as you mentioned, 14 books, including the Book of Trust. It even has a coupon, a discount coupon for my Trusted at Work series of courses. So all of this is made especially for your viewers. And it's at YoramSolomon.com/yourintendedmessage.
That's the website. It's at YoramSolomon.com/yourintendedmessage. And Yoram, in case you're wondering, is spelled is Y-O-R-A-M. And so it's Yoram, but it's said Yoram. And that's YoramSolomon.com. Yoram, before we wrap up, what advice, if you could give people one, two, or three tips of what they can do to enhance trust within their workplace?
So I'm going to go, I wrote 3 points for you. I'll start with number three. Number three is less BS, more empathy, and higher intimacy. I already talked about that. You're meeting someone for the first time, meet them in person. When you communicate with them, less BS and more empathy. Number two is say what you mean. And when my daughter went to a PACE class, which is for more advanced students when she was in elementary school, there was a sign on the wall that I really loved. And it said, say what you mean what you say, don't be mean when you say it. So the importance, and I go back to the intimacy and the consistency of your words and your body language, because when you say what you mean, that consistency comes across. When you don't say what you mean, what you say is what I hear. What you mean is what I see in your body language, and I can feel the inconsistency. But the first one that I want them to take, I want your viewers to take, is to own your side of miscommunications. You know, communications is about me sending a message from my brain to your brain. That's the hope. The hope is that exactly what started in my brain ends in your brain. Well, here's what happens in reality. Something forms in my brain, and then it comes out of my mouth. Did it ever happen to you that the words that came out of your mouth were not what started in your brain, or it sounded so much better in your head? Well, but it's still, this is what came out of my mouth. Then something hit your ears. Well, there's noise. I don't know if you heard, somebody was apparently mowing the lawn outside of my house, not exactly outside, but it was pretty close. So of course, perfect timing, but there's noise, and the noise prevents you from hearing exactly what comes out of my mouth. And then there is the prism of your cognitive abilities and thoughts and assumptions and notions and everything that changes that message from your ears to your brain. The end of this is that what started in my brain is not exactly what ended in your brain. And the big question is, obviously, whose fault is it? And, you know, we like to say it's the other person. So, George, you did not understand a single word of what I said. Well, when I say this to you, I put you on the defense. By the way, on the flip side, and you're not cooperative when you do that. On the flip side, if you said something that I didn't understand, I'm going to say, George, you can't explain anything. Once again, I put you on the defense. However, miscommunication is owned by both of us. If I take ownership to my side, such as, George, that's not exactly what I meant. Let me try and say it in a different way. Maybe I'll explain it better. Now you're not on the defense. Now you're trying to help me convey the message. And that's effective communication. That's how I get my intended message to you. Or in the other way around, if you're trying to get your intended message to me, then, and I didn't get it, I would say, George, I don't think I understood what you meant. Is there another way you can say it to me that I'll understand it? Once again, not putting you on the defense. So that would be my number one, on your side of miscommunication.
Powerful advice. A lot of valuable and thoughtful ideas in there, Yoram. I appreciate that. My guest today is Yoram Solomon, reminding you that trust will get you 29.6% more when you're selling.
If you like what you heard, remember to like, comment, and share this podcast. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.